You're listening to Nowhere to Run with Chris White on the Revelations Radio Network. Hey everybody, welcome to Nowhere to Run. My name is Chris. Thank you for downloading this episode. However it is that you found this podcast, I'm glad that you did. And if you have any questions for me, you can go to my website, nowheretorunradio.com, or you can email me directly at any number of direct email addresses, such as nowheretorun1984@gmail.com or chris@ancientaliensdebunked.com. They all go to the same place. Speaking of Ancient Aliens Debunked, I'm sure that some of you are pretty fed up with hearing about Ancient Aliens Debunked from me. This podcast has pretty much been talking about it for at least since I got back from Africa, and even before that, as I was doing research, I always had something to say about it. And then if you're a subscriber to the Revelations Radio Network, you've heard me at least three interviews recently on the network about this. Although, I would say that those interviews were diverse in their material and that each one is different, so I encourage you to listen to all of them if you're even a little bit interested. But I've been doing a lot of podcasts and interviews lately, and there are a lot of really good ones that are scheduled upcoming, and they're all just really great opportunities to talk about the ancient astronaut theory. And I think I mentioned on Facebook that this is something that, for this month, I really want to try to follow through well with this. Something that I haven't really done with a lot of other projects is really try to contend well against some of the, critics and things like that, and do interviews and really try to promote it. Just because I feel like it's got such a good potential to really change the debate about the ancient astronaut theory. And I think it's a debate that's important. So I really want to try to do what I can to make this issue more, to shed some light on it and to get the debate going in the right direction, hopefully, and to give people tools for that debate. I think that was the main purpose of the thing. So really exciting interviews that I've done, some really exciting interviews yet to do, been confirming some really big ones, actually. So I'm excited about that and excited to see where it goes. So, yeah, the video is doing really well. I haven't checked it in a while, but it's been, I guess, probably almost 320 or something thousand views just from the ones that I know about, and I've seen other people's uploads of it that are also doing well. So I don't know how many, but it's certainly more than I've had for any project in the past. So it's great, but as a result of that, I've also been keeping really busy, for example, with emails alone. It's just almost getting to the point where I can't really get to all of them, although I don't really want to actually have to admit that, so I'm still trying to get to everybody like I normally do. But, for example, today is a day that I usually spend doing emails the entire day, and I just, there was just too many. It was too daunting, so I got through as many as I can, the important ones, and I'll save the rest for later. So I'm chipping away at them. I'll say it that way. So give me some grace, period, if you've got an email to me that's moderate to importance, then I will try to get to it in time. If it's really important, I will continue to get to it as quickly as I can. So anyway, let's talk just real briefly about some notes about Ancient Aliens Debunked, and I promise I'll try to move on to something less Ancient Aliens Debunked-y. The website Ancient Aliens Debunked has been progressing well. I've been really excited about that and keeping that a good website for people wanting to learn more about the skeptical viewpoint of the ancient astronaut theory. The blog and podcast are the main things that are there that I hope to be helpful in that regard. If you're interested in following the Twitter or the blog, I encourage you to do that. I am trying to actually keep the Twitter going pretty well and to keep it relevant. As I mentioned, a podcast is also something that I'm trying to do rather well with this. So I'm actually producing the podcast and, you know, putting music and stuff and all that stuff to it. And you can check that out at ancientaliensdebunked.com. The last podcast was on the Dogon Sirius mystery. Also the Piri Reis map, the face and pyramids on Mars, and the Phoenix Lights. And you can find detailed discussions of those at the website in different blog entries where I've got links to different places where you can learn about that. And I want to do more with those kind of items, the things that I might not have covered in the film. A lot of people are asking, you know, what about this issue? What about that issue? So this gives me an opportunity to look into those issues and then report on them on the blog. So check that out if you're interested. Also on that podcast is the audio version of Ancient Aliens Debunked. Some people have been asking me about that. And so it's on iTunes as well, in the Ancient Aliens Debunked podcast. So one other website-related issue. I just posted a link on the right side of Ancient Aliens Debunked to my response to Philip Coppens. That's essentially what it says there on the right side, my response to Philip Coppens. Philip Coppens is one of the stars of Ancient Aliens on the History Channel. He's the guy with long hair and speaks in a British accent. He actually appears in quite a number of episodes. So he wrote an article called Debunking Ancient Aliens Debunked, in which he brought up a few different points, some of the things he was real familiar with, like the crystal skulls and a number of other issues. It was limited in scope, but I mean, you can't blame him. I mean, the film was 3 hours long or whatnot, so there's a lot of things that he didn't hit. But the things that he did hit, I found to be really wrong, easily debunked stuff. It was just, in terms of the content of his arguments, it was really poor. In addition, there was a lot of just ad hominems and other things that were problematic with it, but the meat of the thing was problematic too. And if you see my response to him, it's a point-by-point refutation. You can read my response and basically hear everything that he had to say. I made it a point not to cut out anything that was important to his point. So you can see that at the website, ancientaliensdebunked.com, my response to Philip Coppens. His article has been posted by Von Daniken, Giorgio Tsoukalos, the hair guy, has retweeted it a number of times, saying some pretty inflammatory things when he reposts it. But it's unfortunate because it is such poor argumentation. But it's like so many of the other things about the ancient astronaut theory. If you don't know anything about the history of the crystal skull or whatever, and you heard him say this article, you would believe him. I mean, you'd have no reason not to. He says it so matter-of-factly. Same thing with the ancient astronaut theory in general. I mean, they just say things really matter-of-factly, and it just is like, well, that's true. I mean, if they say it like that, I mean, that's got to be true. There's no need to look it up. So that's kind of the similar way that this is done. A lot of things were just said, and the only people that would ever catch it are people that have actually looked into that. Anyway, so I encourage you to check that out. So I think I'm going to stop talking about Ancient Aliens Debunked, but I am going to continue talking about some of the issues that are similar. I want to talk at length about the idea that the Sphinx was eroded by water, and that means that the Sphinx is 9 or 10,000 years old, which is much, much older than the Egyptologists believe it is. And so therefore it was made by Atlanteans or aliens or just somebody, somehow us, even in a bygone, forgotten era, whatever view you take on that. I certainly have heard this for a long time. It's a view that a guy named John Anthony West and a geologist named Robert Schock. I think it's Robert. Anyway, his last name is Schock, S-C-H-O-C-H. And they have put this theory forward based on the erosion. And it's an interesting thing because in looking into this and reading about it, and one good thing about this is that most of the debates about this issue have been played out in journals, in actual scholarly circles. This issue has kind of gone back and forth. And one good thing about that is that you've got lots and lots of interested, smart people who may disagree violently against the theory, but at least they are forced to say something intelligent as a rebuttal to it. And then often what happens, especially if it kind of goes back and forth in journals like this, is that you get resolution on some issues. Some issues get just thrown by the, you know, are not proposed anymore because they have been proven wrong. And one thing I've found in this debate, though the scholarly journal debate really ended about 2001 or somewhere around there hasn't been a lot of published material on this particular debate. But there has been other published material that is relative to this, but that's pretty much done. But what you find in that is that a lot of things actually were resolved. For example, when you look on Google or whatever and you type in water erosion and the Sphinx, the pictures that you're going to see that are obviously water erosion are not on the Sphinx body. They're actually the so-called Western enclosure wall. Okay, so the Sphinx is actually sitting in like a big rectangle. It's surrounded by a big enclosure, which, you know, it was quarried out. Actually, the stones that they know for sure, even people that, you know, agree that it, you know, think it's old, agree that the stones that it was that were quarried to make this big rectangle around the Sphinx were used to create the temple in front of the Sphinx. Or at least there's two phases of that temple, but one of the first phase was used by those rocks. So anyway, there's this big rectangle, and on the western side of that rectangle only, well, that's not true, on the southern side towards the western end, there's also this same thing, is this water erosion. Now, the western side is the side facing the pyramid, so most of you know that the Sphinx is facing the rising sun. Which is probably no accident. It was probably part of a solar cult early on, but nevertheless, behind it is the pyramids, and on that side of the rectangle is where you're going to see this water erosion. Now there is some anomalies on the Sphinx itself as well, but from my reading of the debates among Shock and these other guys, that it's pretty well determined that what's on the Sphinx, the anomalies in terms of erosion on the Sphinx are a result of what they're calling exfoliation, two types of exfoliation that is widely known about and is certainly even is happening even today as a result of other conditions. But before that, the conditions were, I should go into this just a little bit, but before I do, let me explain something about the body of the Sphinx itself. The body of the Sphinx is composed entirely of one stone. However, that stone is actually in three different layers. Most of you know that stone is kind of laid down in different layers, and each of those layers have different qualities. Some are harder than others. And the Sphinx, though it was carved from one stone, has three different layers. The bottom layer more or less covers the bottom half of the Sphinx. It's kind of whatever, I don't want to describe it too much, but the second layer, the body, is a different type. It's actually the weaker type. If you know much about the Sphinx, it's actually, you know, it's really eroded there in the middle. And then the head is actually one of the hardest of the stones. That's probably why the face has remained intact for so long. Nevertheless, it's one of the harder types. So the erosion on the Sphinx, or so-called, the way I was always described this is that there was wind erosion on the Sphinx, and some of it was wind erosion and some of it was water erosion. I don't think really anybody buys that too much. I mean, the problem, of course, with that, if you're trying to say that it was water erosion at first 10,000 years ago and then wind erosion later, wind erosion would obliterate the water erosion at some point if it was all as simple as that. But that's not what even, as far as I can gather, even John Anthony West and Shock are proposing anymore. But so what's on the Sphinx is now agreed to really not even be the issue. It's almost gone. It's proposed that depending on the type or the quality of each layer, and really that quality is dependent upon a few different issues. One is pores. Each of these rocks have pores, just holes in the rock. And in those pores, there's salt crystals. So the question about their durability is based entirely on the number of pores and the amount of salt in those pores. The reason that's important is this process that I'm going to describe as salt exfoliation is when you have any kind of water, and this is true whether it is the daily up and down dew in the driest conditions of the Giza Plateau, you're going to get this dew in the morning that would make the pores, the outer layer would be, this water would seep into it. It would make the salt, it would essentially, you know, the salt would be liquefied or whatever. As it dried and it dried out, the salt crystals would expand the pores and it would break because they would crystallize and whatnot. And then as they broke, then it would just kind of keep eroding in and in and in. And that's been that's not even a question. I mean, that's happening all around the Giza Plateau. It's been amplified because of pollution and other issues. But even before that, another thing that's accepted, as far as I can tell by everybody involved in this, is the issues of this also happening from the inside out because of groundwater, which is no longer an issue because the groundwater is lower now, but it was a part of this process before. So whatever anomalies that are on the Sphinx are pretty much dismissed. Everybody is focusing on the western closure wall. Everybody, I mean, and the western part of the southern wall as well. Now, the reason why this same extreme water erosion is not anywhere else in the whole place, I mean, is because it is water runoff from the Giza Plateau. And remember, the Giza Plateau is a big plateau. And so what would happen when it would rain, this is the place downhill of all of this stuff, that water would collect and run off into the western enclosure wall and down, you know, around the Sphinx and everything else when it would rain. And it wouldn't even have to be extremely heavy rains. It would just have to be sort of normal rains in a cyclical time. So the problem with this is not something you're going to hear in any of these specials with John Anthony West or whatever. I was watching one last night, and never once, I mean, he always says, you know, we need to go back 10,000 years because that's the earliest time that there was constant rainfall, like in these conditions of constant rainfall, because he needs to make this rainfall beating down on this thing be the agent of this thing. Because if he says that, hey, it's okay that this is water runoff, then you can date this thing as, I mean, really, really early. In fact, he is true that there was an extremely, extremely wet time at the Giza Plateau, you know, back 10,000 years ago or whatever. But the following 4,000 years, which is about the space between when it probably really was built, and I'm going to talk about the dating, because the reason this works is because they are true. This isn't that the modern Egyptologists have this wrong, but not by 4,000 years, but instead by 400 years. And I'll talk about that in a minute. So the 4,000 year period between the extremely, extremely wet period and the current arid conditions, or rather, I'll take it back, the 4,000 years when it was built, you didn't have just an immediate drop off of that. You had a slow declining of this, even seasonal rains, much like we have here. You know, some of them are heavier than others. The type of water erosion that's on the western enclosure of the Sphinx is something that could happen really, really quickly in terms of geological time. Extremely quickly, in fact. It would just take, I mean, if you're talking about the water collecting in all the entire Giza Plateau being concentrated to this one area on the western side of it. And of course, that explains why this stuff isn't happening on any of the other walls of the enclosure or on the Sphinx or anything else, even monuments that are around. There are lots of things that people try to say, you know, what about these? Well, let me first deal with the age of the thing. So the thing is, like, usually said to be a part of the Khafre pyramid. I think it's Menik. I'm going to get my pyramid names wrong, but I think, anyway, it's one of the other pyramids. And that's the one it's usually associated with, and it was later on, of course, associated with that. And so that's the modern Egyptologist position, although they are changing that position in large numbers because of this new research. This debate has forced Egyptology to recognize that erosion couldn't have happened until at least before Khufu, because Khufu's quarries, I mentioned in the Ancient Aliens Debunked video, that the pyramids are built in their own quarries, basically. The whole plateau is this massive quarry site, so it's not like they had to drag these blocks very far. But the problem is that Khufu's quarry and subsequent quarries actually had to be built after the erosion had already been there on the Sphinx, because the quarries would have actually prevented the water from going where they naturally would have to create that issue. But that's not the only reason that they date this to about what they would say early dynastic. In other words, about 400 years earlier than the current belief. And it's consistent with other issues around the site, other archaeological finds. And it makes sense. This is why something like this of John Anthony West or Schott can actually really take off, because it's really true. Egyptology really did have it wrong. They were dating the Sphinx to a wrong time, and it was because there really was water erosion. So there's so many true things, but the burden of proof now, from it, as far as I can tell from all these the papers and things like that, is it's firmly in Schott's court. He's now got to do something to try to disprove that this. I mean, he's got to first be full out and aware that this theory of the water eroding as a result of floodwaters accumulating on the plain, as instead of constant rainfall, he's got to be able to say, okay, that is not true for such and such reason, and that doesn't explain. And he's got to explain why there isn't the same stuff on either of the other sides of the Sphinx enclosure. As I mentioned, he already has admitted for the most part that the salt exfoliation on the Sphinx body itself is pretty much a non-factor, and everybody is seeming to agree that that's not really, it's water erosion in one sense, but it's a different function of water erosion, and that it's being exfoliated rather than, you know, just eroded because of runoff. So that's kind of where that is. And he's either got to prove that 4,000-year period between there, that there wasn't enough rain. He's got another theory about some subterranean stuff, but he's going to have to drill somewhere in Giza if he wants that to be an issue or whatever, which is something he's going to have to do. But the problem with this thing is that he doesn't really have to at this point. Even though the ball's in his court and everybody's pretty much... doesn't believe that anymore in terms of the actual circles of scholars and stuff like that. The pop culture, it doesn't really matter. Nobody really even knows about this stuff. And so as far as the public is concerned, he's done it. He's, figured it all out, and nobody even knows that this issue isn't about the Sphinx, but instead about the western side of the enclosure wall. And so there's no need for him to do anything or say anything. As long as nobody's challenging him, then he is winning, basically. So it's unfortunate that it's believed and used so much to get all kinds of New Age theories going and stuff like that. Anybody familiar with this stuff knows that that's like the springboard for whatever New Age thing that you've got going on. But anyway... And I'll post some links in the show notes if you want to learn more about this. Some of the papers and so on about this issue are kind of hard to read because they're geology, and I don't know if I'm the only one that thinks geology is really boring, but technical geology is even more boring. But the other issue is that the language that they use, which is true with pretty much any kind of scientific paper, that you kind of have to learn a little bit about their language and what they're referring to with certain words and concepts and stuff. And then once you get that, though, it's pretty easy to follow along, but it does take just a little bit of a curve to get going with some of this stuff. But nevertheless, I'll put it in the show notes. The other issue that I wanted to talk briefly about is Yonaguni. This is the underwater pyramids, or the Japanese Atlantis, various names for it. Again, the name is Yonaguni, Yonaguni. And this is something that Graham Hancock has promoted and others have promoted as being evidence for civilization 10,000 years ago. He actually tries to tie this into the Sphinx thing, trying to say that they're essentially from the same era, trying to say it's, Atlantis or whatnot. Maybe even if they don't call it Atlantis, it's essentially the concept they're trying to convey with this. The idea being that if this is man-made and it's underwater, the earliest time that it could have been above water based on ice age dating and things like that was about 10,000 years ago. So therefore there was a civilization 10,000 years ago, and we all need to recalibrate our understanding of civilization and so on. So the problem with this one is that it is a pretty, well, if you take a look at this site, first of all, it's like one big underwater mountain, basically, or plateau or something like that. It's one piece of rock. And that's actually Robert Schock, who is the guy we've been talking about, who is promoting the idea that the Sphinx is 10,000 years old. he's a geologist that, you know, the darling of sort of the conspiracy world. So, of course, they bring this guy out to the Yonaguni Monument, because if anybody's going to be okay with saying that the thing is 10,000 years old, it's going to be this guy who's already on the record saying he believes that civilization was around then. But he actually came to the site and said, no, it's not 10,000 years. It's not man-made, and therefore it doesn't really matter how old it is. It's a natural formation. If you look at pictures of this thing, you'll see that the main thing is that the idea is it's flat, like just totally flat rock right next to what appears to be like a 90 degree area. So it's like these big, huge steps. Okay. They're not even steps by any stretch of the imagination. They're wildly divergent steps. They would be impossible steps to climb, even for like a, you know, giant. But the idea is that they were, you know, this big temple complex. And the idea is that you don't get these formations in nature, these direct 90-degree things, which, you know, on the surface is, of course, you know, why would you get those 90-degree things? You've got a flat area there right next to what appears to be a perpendicular, you know, wall. But that is actually a well-known geological issue. What basically happens is that since stone is put down in layers, and depending on the composition of those layers, of course, as the layers are flat, I mean, the layers are laid down because of gravity and, you know, sediment laying down in a flat area. So if you've got one layer of sediment that's hardened or whatnot, then you've got another one on top of that, and they're different, they're not like glued together or anything technically, then one could easily slide off. The difference at Yonaguni is, so everybody knows that's a possibility, and that there are all kinds of natural occurring things which appear to be flat, you know, whatever rock, which is just a result of them sliding off because of the way that the sediment layers are put down. But Yonaguni is a little bit different because it's in Japan, which is around the so-called Ring of Fire. It's one of the most geologically unstable places on Earth. Lots of volcanic activity, earthquakes, all the stuff that comes along with that, tsunamis and everything else. Well, what's happened here is that not only is this thing essentially ready to slide off because of the layers, but it was also cracked due to earthquakes in the opposite direction. The sort of, you know, it was cracked long ways or width ways as well a few times. So it's kind of like a birthday cake, you know, a multi-layered cake that's been chopped into, you know, sections, and then certain parts of it have slid off. And as you mentioned, Graham Hancock's thing is that this current is so strong there, and so that's why Robert Schock didn't really get a good look at it, because if he would have got a good look at it, he would have said it was man-made, but instead Robert Schock said, no, it's not. It's a pretty standard geological formation. But let me read what he said, because it's not just like, well, he didn't really get a good look at it. He makes a few really good points. Schock says, quote, "The structure is, as far as I could determine, composed entirely of solid living bedrock. No part of the monument is constructed of separate blocks of rock that have been placed into position. This is an important point, for carved and arranged rock blocks would definitely indicate a man-made origin of the structure, yet I could find no such evidence." And then he says this is an interesting thing too. He says, "These rocks contain numerous well-defined parallel bedding planes along which the layers easily separate. The rocks of this group are also crisscrossed by numerous sets of parallel and vertical joints and fractures. Yonaguni lies in an earthquake-prone region. Such earthquakes tend to fracture the rocks in a regular manner. The more I compared the natural but highly regular weathering and erosional features observed on the modern coast of the islands with the structural characteristics of Yonaguni Monument, the more I became convinced that the Yonaguni Monument is primarily the result of natural, geological, and geomorphological processes at work. On the surface, I also found depressions and cavities forming naturally that look exactly like the supposed post holes that some researchers have noticed on the underwater Yonaguni Monument." So that's why he says that he doesn't believe it's man-made. And there are other places you can see pictures of this stuff, like he's talking about, above ground as well. But if you ever get a chance to look at this on, like, Google Image Search or whatever, you search Yonaguni, and you see the drawing, the schematic of this entire complex, which is, you know, as one big rock, one big plateau-looking thing, and you see all the different supposed levels or steps, staircases is what they look like, you know, really irregular off staircases. That's really what did it for me, is looking at this thing and thinking, who in the right mind would do anything like this? I mean, it makes no sense from a perspective of, like, okay, let's make this monument and let's make just a bunch of completely useless staircases. Like, on the right side here, I want three useless staircases. And then I want two staircases over here that go off a sheer cliff. And you pretty much have to be looking at a picture of this to think that's funny. But anyway, so I think I'm just going to leave that issue and the Sphinx issue there. I would like to find a way to demonstrate that in a more clear way in the future. I may do some more work on that. But for now, I'm probably just going to settle with some blog posts and podcasts about these issues as I continue to search for more ancient astronaut theory issues to debunk. Okay, there's two other issues I want to talk about in this podcast, and I think both of them have the potential to really change somebody's life for the better. They're just small ideas that could explain so much stuff in your life and really make you have a better life. So I'm going to take the chance that at least somebody out there is in need of this information, and though many of you may not benefit from it, I think it's still worth doing. The first thing is about being an introvert versus being an extrovert and the fact that that's okay. And I think realizing that there are physiological differences between the two and seeing some of the studies about the advantages and the good things about being an introvert and basically how to deal with that in an extrovert world just takes a lot of weight off somebody that's been thinking that there's something wrong with them, that they're not right, that they are not good somehow because they're not an extrovert. But let me read a description from a book that I've been reading. It says, "Why Being an Introvert is a Good Thing." The book is called Introverts at Ease, An Insider's Guide to a Great Life on Your Terms. Why Being an Introvert is a Good Thing and How to Make it Great for You. Depending on who you listen to, introverts make up 25 to 50% of the U.S. population, or between 80 and 160 million people. That's a lot of self-aware folks with strong powers of observation, concentration, and focus. But many of us don't feel strong or energetic and even wonder if there's something wrong with us. Some of us don't even realize we're introverts. The latest research shows that introverts are hardwired differently, with specific energy and lifestyle needs that sometimes conflict with those of extroverts. It's not about becoming more extroverted, it's about allowing yourself to think and behave in ways more suitable to being an introvert in an extroverted culture. Introvert expert Nancy Okerlund captures the essence of the introvert dilemma and provides realistic strategies and techniques to help you create a more energized and fulfilling life. Learn to recognize the impact of your hardwiring on your body and your energy levels, negative stereotypes, and begin to see introversion as a strength. Unsatisfying behaviors you can replace with an introvert's way of doing things, extrovert skill sets and behavior without trying to become an extrovert. So I thought I would just plant this seed in case anybody has been dealing with some kind of depression or thinking that there's something wrong with them or anything like this. Or like my wife had been, she always felt sort of overwhelmed with things to do. Like she never got enough done. It was sort of a thing that this book explains and actually has solved the problem, that it's a result of essentially kind of introverts sort of need time alone and time doing things on their own terms in order to sort of build back up their tank, as it were. And if they're always doing extroverted things and going here and doing this thing or whatever, it sort of drains them. And it's really been a game changer for us. I mean, we're not extreme. Well, I may be extreme introvert. I really would prefer, and always have preferred, the more intimate settings with close personal friends, or just being alone, to the party situations or the meeting new people things. I don't dislike them. I can thrive well in them if need be, but I don't prefer it. But so my wife and I are the same in that regard. But you may not be an introvert, but you may your spouse or significant other or your friend or whatnot may be an introvert, and I think this might help to understand their dilemma a little better. Also, I don't know if I recommend this book or some of the others on Amazon. This one is really good. It seems to be like a simple way of explaining it. The person here, Nancy Okerlund, she's a little on the new agey side. There's some issues in there where it's clearly some new age kind of stuff or whatnot. There's some more scholarly versions of this, but this one's been good. I mean, if you can overlook some of that stuff, it's not too bad. But I just wanted to mention that, because I think it may be, as it has been in our house, a great way. We both feel so much better about being in extroverted type situations now, because it's okay, you know, I realize now what the issue is, and all the pressure's off. It's like it says, introverts at ease. So it really did accomplish what it set out to do. So that's a unsolicited promotion of that book there. Another thing I want to talk about is something that I also think can just change lives for the better. Practical things that can set some people totally free. In fact, in the last year, maybe 2 years, I've known at least two people that were on the verge of suicide because they didn't know what I'm about to say. And it's somewhat complex. I'm going to give it a term of one of the more severe things that can happen, although what I'm about to describe reaches beyond that. Leaky gut syndrome is something that happens when your intestinal lining gets holes in it. There are lots of different things that can cause those holes to happen. One is sometimes you can just take antibiotics and be in conjunction with a few other things and it can happen. There are any number of issues, including a diet that's really high in sugar or yeast or anything. And a combination of those, essentially what happens is an overgrowth of yeast can essentially cause holes in the intestinal lining. That part's really not that debated. But what happens if you have holes in your intestinal lining can really manifest in a lot of different ways. And I guarantee there are people listening to me that have continued terrible health problems that their doctors don't know what to do about and all this other stuff that will be solved if you try what I'm about to suggest to you to do. And even if your issue isn't specifically leaky gut, I would encourage anybody out there that has a suspicion that their health problems are a result of diet, let me offer you a solution to see if this helps. So what happens is if you have holes in your intestinal lining, first of all, you lose vitamins. 70% of your vitamins are absorbed through your intestines. If you have a hole in your intestinal lining, you're going to have malabsorption. You're going to start losing massive amounts of vitamins. And unless they're supplemented, you're going to start getting symptoms that are going to be all over the board. You know, what happens if you lose a lot of B12? What happens if you have very little vitamin D or vitamin E or all these different things that will cause separate problems to happen? And of course, what does a person do that has no thought that could be any issue? They go to the doctor. The doctor, unfortunately, never says anything. Let's take some blood and see if you're deficient in any vitamins. It seems like in a perfect world, that would be what you would do. That's actually how we ended up finding some of the problems of this with my wife is she had blood tests and they were like, wow, you are deficient in some serious vitamins. But that was after getting pretty close on her own after years of trying to figure out what was going on here. But anyway, another issue that happens besides malabsorption and therefore vitamin deficiency is the fact that whatever you eat will go into your bloodstream to a certain extent. Obviously not all of it, but certain parts of it will go into your bloodstream. And that causes a number of bad things to happen. One is that if it's very processed food or has a lot of chemicals in it or things like that, your body's going to react in a terribly negative way to that. So you'll be really susceptible if you're eating just terrible food. But in addition to that, it also causes a huge number of food allergies. Because food allergies that change and develop over time, because especially if you eat a lot of some particular thing, because anything that gets into your bloodstream that much, your body's going to be like, okay, immunity to this thing, immunity to that thing. So you're actually developing a number of immunities. One of the primary things that happens in addition to this is you get intolerant to gluten and other issues like that. Sugar is a big thing that causes all kinds of adverse reactions. The adverse reactions usually are stomach issues, diarrhea, various things that happen like that. If you know anybody that is coughing or clearing their throat a lot after they eat a meal, after about 10 or 20 minutes, I can't tell you how many people I know that do that. That's not necessarily the same thing. But it will be solved by the same issue. One thing I'll say about all this stuff, regardless of if anything that I'm saying is, you know, exactly what you're dealing with, the solution is the same. If it's in any way resulting, you know, if you have, let's say, what do they call it, celiac disease or just gluten intolerance or allergic to other foods or whatnot, almost all of that will be fixed by a diet that eliminates sugar and wheat. It sounds like a chore, and let me tell you, at first it seems like a chore because everything in the grocery store is sugar and wheat. You know, people come up with a lot of diets and things like that. As far as if you're interested in losing weight, this will do it because fat actually is essentially sugars. If you take away wheat and sugar, because the wheat is and wheat products are essentially what is transformed into a glucose. And sugar obviously is sugar itself. So if you take away those things, you're going to start burning fat reserves like almost instantly. So people that do this tend to lose a lot of weight. If you have a severe overgrowth of yeast and you're noticing that, whether it's skin irritation issues or any number of things, yeast infections and the kind of, it wouldn't show up in a guy as much, but it is still an overgrowth of yeast is very, very common in our diets. And if you feel like this is an issue in your life, I would also suggest getting, in addition to this diet, is initially at least taking some fungal herbal stuff like you can get at one of the vitamin stores, like Fungal Defense, or that's the Garden of Life one. But there's other ones that are really good and really strong. Just ask your local hippie health store provider which one is the best in their opinion. But if you supplement that with that, you're going to really notice a huge difference. Once the die-off of the yeast happens, life changes for the better. Although it's a little difficult. Sometimes the die-off of the yeast causes other problems because it's sort of like a gets worse before it gets better kind of thing. Sometimes it's really hard to quit drinking, you know, if you're used to drinking Cokes and you're used to eating a lot of wheat and sugar, you kind of have withdrawals at first. So the first week or two sometimes can be very difficult. You might not even feel very good because there's a lot of die off and the toxins that are already there are dying off and stuff like that. But once that hump is over with, and it wasn't that bad for me, but it's not a big deal. Anyway, a few suggestions about that if you do want to try this, and I would recommend, even if you're skeptical and you're used to some kind of illness that you're used to dealing with every morning or every day, or, you know, you just figured some kind of illness was a part of your life and you're just going to have to deal with it and whatever, just give this 2 or 3 days. Just consciously don't eat anything that has sugar or wheat in it, and that includes fruit. I mean, fruit sugars you can add later on after you're sort of healed a little bit from all this stuff. But even eliminate that. Anything that's wheat or sugar, even rice, you can eat brown rice. Anything that falls under like a candida diet is sometimes the way. It's a pretty strict diet, but it's actually not that bad. You can eat potatoes. I mean, you can eat, you know, French fries and that kind of thing. Potato chips, as long as they don't have too much preservatives and those kind of things that can also harm you. But you know, vegetables and meat and all kinds of stuff falls into that category that doesn't have sugar or wheat in it. So you don't really feel that bad. You can even have pasta, things like quinoa pasta. I love quinoa spaghetti. It's really, really, really good. As far as Cokes and stuff, I always get these things called LaCroix. They are flavored. This one I got here is natural berry flavored sparkling water. There's nothing in it. I mean, it's got a little bit of natural flavor of the berry thing, but it's carbonated water in a can, so it tastes like, my brain thinks I'm drinking a Coke whenever I drink one. I originally got hooked on these things when I was quitting drinking beer because I was so used to having a beer. But then after I started quitting drinking Cokes, I always wanted a Coke or something when I was eating a meal or something. So these things fit right in. And, you know, you don't even miss them after a while. So I really highly recommend those. Little LaCroix, there's other ones out there, of course, like Perrier or San Pellegrino or whatnot. Sparkling water, that'd probably be a little more healthy for you. But I also would recommend, the vitamins and whatnot. Getting good vitamins, if you are serious about this, get tested to see if, you know, get some blood done to see if you are deficient in any particular vitamin. My wife was so low in vitamin B12 and other B vitamins that she had started to get severe problems as a result of that because of the loss of vitamins. And a person that also has this is going to be more susceptible to side effects of drugs and things like that. So it's this vicious cycle. If you go to the doctor and you're having all these problems, these medical problems that could be as simple as you don't have the vitamins you need. You are putting toxins directly into your bloodstream because everything that you eat is going into your bloodstream and you're not watching what you're eating, or you could have an overgrowth of yeast, or all three of those things, or just one of those things would cause you to go to the doctor and get misdiagnosed. And once you're misdiagnosed, they'll give you some, what do doctors do? They give you some drugs that will then go directly into your bloodstream and give you the worst possible side effects for those drugs. So it's a terrible, terrible vicious cycle if you're trying to fix yourself and this is your issue. But the solution to this is a healthy diet that eliminates wheat and sugar. That includes white rice as well. You can look at the other diets out there about this. Candida is a diet, is a search term. You can find more about it. But I mention it here because there are any number of things that could be happening in your life that are a result of an overgrowth of yeast, or a result of you not getting enough vitamins, or a result of toxins in your bloodstream, a result of allergies to foods that develop. This is just a terrible thing that any one of those four things will cause all kinds of weird things to happen in your body and in your life. And so I just want you to know that it can be, if this is your issue, that of course it can be fixed by dealing with your diet and doing a little bit of research in this. If you've got any questions, my wife, I'm sure, would love to talk to anybody that has any questions about this, and you can email me and I can forward it to her. It's something that she is, she wants to talk to people about if they are interested. So you can email me and I'll forward it to her. So I hope those two things help somebody out there. I can just imagine there's at least one or two people that could be helped by some of that pretty practical information. And I also want to request prayers from you, prayers out there, just about the next few weeks for me in the promotion of the film and trying to get this information out about the ancient astronaut theory. There's a lot of people out there that need to hear it, and just pray that God takes care of that and gets it to the people that need to hear it, and that you give me strength to do it. It's trying sometimes because it's more popular. It's also a little bit more negative than I'm used to. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on. So I would really appreciate some of your prayers about all that stuff, that God's will would be accomplished in it, and that he would give us strength to do it all. Thanks a lot for listening. You can email me at nowheretorunradio.com, and I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to the show. I would like to send anyone who is interested something I've been calling the Christianity 101 DVD. It's a totally free DVD which contains 8 gigabytes of audio and video that I think will be helpful for Christians or anyone interested in Christianity. You can go to nowheretorunradio.com or chriswhiteministries.com to order one. It's 100% totally free, and I will ship it anywhere in the world. You can download the archives of this show for free at nowheretorunradio.com. On that site, you can also see many of the other projects and websites that I'm a part of, such as Verse by Verse Bible Teaching, or Stop Sleep Paralysis, or Ancient Aliens Debunked. There you can also get a link to my YouTube page, where I have over 100 original videos about apologetics and various debunkings, as well as biblical studies and presentations of the gospel. If you would like to hear a detailed presentation of the most important message of the Bible, you can go to my website, dvdtract.com. That's dvdtract.com. You can write to me at chris@chriswhiteministries.com or at P.O. Box 110984, Nashville, Tennessee, 3-7-2-1-1. I try to answer almost every email, however, sometimes it can take up to a week for me to respond. Donations are needed and very appreciated, as well as totally tax deductible. They will help with current and future projects, most of which fall into the category of discipleship and/or evangelism. Thanks for listening.